Chisholm, the spokesman, says the group has not agreed to extend the August 31st deadline for a full withdrawal of American and other foreign troops from Afghanistan. The World Health Organization is warning it only has a week of medical supplies left in Afghanistan. The Ukrainian government denies comments by its deputy foreign minister that one of the country's jets was hijacked at the Kabul airport and flown to Iran. Good to have you with us. The Taliban have rejected the extension of the August 31st deadline for U.S. and other foreign troops to fully withdraw from Afghanistan.
The extension was unilateral by the side of the United States. It was a violation of the agreement. We want them to evacuate all foreign nationals by 31st August.
The Taliban spokesman made a comment at a news conference in capital Kabul. Zabihullah Mujahid said that the Taliban aren't in favor of Afghan nationals leaving the country, urging the United States to stop evacuating skilled Afghans. He also stressed that the Taliban would not allow Afghanistan to be used as a base for attacking other countries. In his comments, Mujahid also said that the formation of a new government in the country will be announced soon. He stressed that the Taliban will cooperate with a future government and its fighters will be recruited into the Afghan army. Meantime, the CIA chief has reportedly met with a top Taliban leader in Afghan capital Kabul. Washington Post, citing unnamed U.S. officials, as saying that William Burns has secretly met with Taliban's co-founder and political leader, Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, on Monday. According to the Post, it was the highest-level face-to-face encounter between the Taliban and the U.S. administration since the group's takeover of Afghanistan. The UN Human Rights Chief says that she has received credible reports that the Taliban have committed serious violations of human rights in Afghanistan.
We have also received credible reports of serious violation of international humanitarian law and human rights abuses taking place in many areas under effective Taliban control. They include, among others, summary executions of civilians and all the combat members of the Afghan National Security Forces, restrictions on the right of women, including the right to move around freely and girls' right to attend school, recruitment of child soldiers, and repression of peaceful protests and expression of dissent.
The bachelor also expressed concerns over the situation of ethnic and religious minorities under the Taliban rule. Addressing the Human Rights Council, she urged the Geneva Forum to set up a mechanism to closely monitor Taliban's actions. She said that a fundamental red line would be the treatment of women, urging the group to honor commitments to respect the rights of women and girls. The Taliban took control of Afghanistan earlier this month and declared the formation of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. Much is made of the so-called special relationship between the UK and the US. Both countries have many of the same interests. Both are strong proponents of promoting liberal democracy and free trade around the world, often by force, of course. But this month's unilateral decision by the US to withdraw troops from Afghanistan has exposed the shakiness of the decades-long transatlantic relationship. Said Puruza takes a closer look.
A special relationship. A term coined after the Second World War by then-British Prime Minister Winston Churchill to describe his country's close bilateral ties with former colony the U.S., from economic to cultural to military. Decades later, that supposed strong bond seems to exist in all but name.
It was never special. We already discussed the Suez Crisis where the U.S., you know, basically told Britain to get out of the way, slapped it aside like a little child, a recalcitrant child. Tony Blair was the last British Prime Minister who really put a lot of political capital into this so-called special relationship. The price has been thousands of British soldiers killed, over 457 in Afghanistan alone.
Successive U.S. presidents have dealt serious blows to this transatlantic alliance, from Ronald Reagan, who ordered the invasion of Grenada, a Commonwealth country, when Margaret Thatcher was at number 10, the supposed acme of this special relationship, all the way to Trump and now Biden, who ordered the Afghanistan pullout without consulting the UK.
it gives lie to the idea that there ever was a special relationship. It only existed in the deluded minds of British mandarins and British political elites, because they felt they still wanted to feel that Britain was a great power, and that they, even though they didn't have an empire, they still retained an empire state of mind. And that is now being blown right out of the water with the fall of Afghanistan.
In a sign of heightened tensions, the reaction from a man who got the UK involved in US-led wars in Afghanistan and later Iraq, and is a great believer in this special relationship. He has called Biden's decision imbecilic.
A policy can't be decided by slogan. It's got to be decided on the basis of a strategy. And that's a different thing. And that's really the purpose of what I was saying.
With or without a strategy, it's happening. As U.S. troops evacuate defeated, so must their British peers. Just as they went into the country in September 2001, the Taliban have ruled out any extension of the occupation.
If they are intent on continuing the occupation, so it will provoke a reaction.
The exit from Afghanistan is a chaotic one, and the fury at number 10 over being ignored and humiliated is palpable, offering a window into the state of the UK-US relations.
Theirs is a special relationship perennially skewed in Washington's favor, and where junior partner, the UK, plays the role of obedient sidekick. Saeed Pourreza, London.
The World Health Organization is warning it only has a week of medical supplies left in Afghanistan. The head of the WHO's Eastern Mediterranean region says that huge medical supplies are stored in Dubai, but it's not able to deliver them following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan. He added that the Kabul airport has been closed to commercial flights due to chaotic evacuation efforts there. On Sunday, the WHO and UNICEF jointly called for an immediate establishment of a reliable humanitarian air corridor to keep sending essential supplies to the war-torn country. Even prior to the Taliban's takeover, Afghanistan represented the world's third largest humanitarian operation, with more than 18 million people requiring assistance. Now, China is accusing the United States of bullying and hegemonic behavior, and that after Vice President Kamala Harris criticized Beijing over its policies in Asia.
The U.S. can come and go as it wishes and doesn't need to seek the international community's opinions, not even those of its allies. In order to defend America first, the U.S. can arbitrarily smear, suppress, coerce and bully other countries and without paying any price. This is the order the U.S. wants.
Well, the official also said that Washington hides behind the rhetoric of a rules-based global order to defend its practice. He cited the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan as an example of its selfish foreign policy. Earlier on Tuesday, Kamala Harris accused Beijing of intimidating other nations. She made a remark during a visit to Southeast Asia. China and the U.S. have often traded barbs in the past months amid the differences on major issues such as trade and security. In Iran, the parliament is continuing to debate on proposed cabinet lineup of President Ebrahim Raisi for a fourth day. Lawmakers are reviewing the qualifications of four picks on the list for a ministerial post. They've so far discussed 11 out of 19 nominees. Supporters and opponents, candidates, are given the podium to speak for and against them. The proposed ministers will also have the chance to present plans and defend themselves. The four remaining ones will be discussed on Wednesday when a vote of confidence is set to take place. The president will have up to 3 months to name a replacement if any of the proposed ministers fails to win the vote. Raisi says that his lineup is meant to bring justice and progress to the country. The Civil Aviation Organization of Iran has rejected media reports that a Ukrainian aircraft has been hijacked and taken to Iran. The organization's spokesman says that the aircraft took off from the airport in the Afghan capital on Monday. He said that the plane later refueled at the airport in Iran's northeastern city of Mashhad. It then flew to Ukraine's capital and landed there on Monday night. The Iranian aviation official says that evidence of the plane landing in Kiev is available. It will be published shortly. Ukraine has also said that information circulated by some media outlets on a hijack Ukrainian plane is not true. The foreign ministry said that there are no captured Ukrainian planes in Kabul or anywhere else. A Palestinian teenager has been shot dead by Israeli forces during a raid on a refugee camp in the northern-occupied West Bank. In our news review program, my colleague has discussed that issue with our guests.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Israeli forces have killed a Palestinian teenager during an attack on a refugee camp in the northern occupied West Bank. Ahmad Hashash was shot dead during clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinians in Balata refugee camp near Nablus. Troops attacked the camp in the early hours of Tuesday. Israeli soldiers frequently carry out overnight raids on Palestinian neighborhoods in the occupied West Bank. The raids often trigger protests by Palestinian residents and result in clashes with regime forces. In one such incident earlier this month, four Palestinian men were fatally shot in the Jenin refugee camp, also in the north of the West Bank. Tensions have run high across the occupied territories in recent months. Palestinians are outraged at Israel's settlement expansion and its crackdown on worshippers of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Correspondent Mona Kandil joins us from occupied Ramallah to tell us about the latest on this particular incident. And Mick Napier, Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, joins us from Edinburgh. Mick Napier, when you when you hear about such incidents, I was just thinking, Israel has a policy that is reported to be a shoot-and-kill policy when it comes to the people in Gaza, especially. Do you think that Israel can prevent many of these deaths that occur that we continuously keep hearing about, and of course all of this happening under the watchful eye of the international community?
No, the killings are Israeli state policy, endorsed and encouraged from the highest levels by the statements of ministers. I mean, my own government has intelligence sources in Israel. They know exactly what's happening. But we also know that when we hear about these killings, it's deliberate, it's policy, and it's deliberate killing of people who pose no harm to the soldiers. It's the tip of the iceberg. Prize-winning, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges once reported from Gaza, from Rafah, while it was under Israeli military control. And he said he reported the killings of children that day, and he wrote in an American magazine he had seen people lined up and murdered in many countries in the world, Guatemala, Algeria during the civil war and so on. He said he had never seen children killed for sport as they were killed by Israeli soldiers in Rafah in Gaza. The testimony of an unimpeachable witness. We know sometimes the Israelis kill British citizens, like Tom Herndahl or the journalist Miller. And we know that when we have the resources of quite wealthy people in Britain, the Israelis lie and say that these people were killed by Palestinians. Then they say it was a terrible accident. And then they admit the truth and they pay damages to the families. Palestinians have no hope when their children are executed, of being able to get any kind of justice. We also know that occasionally, and one example I happen to know personally, where the radio communications from soldiers were recorded and played on Israeli TV, the killing of a young girl called Iman Al-Hams, that it was deliberate, that some soldiers said, look, she's just a frightened schoolgirl, and the officer said, kill her, and then approached her on the ground and made sure she was dead. And we know from these communications that the officer said, kill a child in this area, even if it is 3 years old. The officer in question was vindicated and exonerated by the Israeli army. So we have videos of executions. We have film of a young man put on the ground, stripped almost naked, and then executed with a shot to the head. We know of industrial scale maimings by snipers in Gaza during the Great March of Return. And so Israel does what Israel does. It kills Palestinians. But you know, there's a big danger and there's also a big hope. And after the Americans were defeated in Vietnam, they passed massive amounts of aid to Israel to avoid American soldiers, boots on the ground, they called them. And now that they've been crushed in Afghanistan, whatever you think of the Taliban, they defeated the Americans. And the danger is that America will subcontract to Israel its control of the Middle East. But you know, they're also very worried. There's a testimony, I think yesterday, of a Danish member of parliament who went to Palestine and had a meeting with the person who's to become their ambassador to Denmark. And she said, they're afraid. They are afraid of people learning more and more about what Israel is doing. And I think Israel knows it's sitting on a volcano. The killing will continue. It will probably accelerate because they think that Biden is occupied elsewhere. But they know they're sitting on a volcano, and world public opinion one day will explode. We've seen this, the previous story you gave of people occupying factories to prevent arms getting to Israel, but also dock workers around the world taking action against Israeli ships. This can only grow. And so I say to the beleaguered and tortured people of Palestine, we will win ultimately.
Okay.
For the moment, it's agony for the Palestinians. Israel is killing, yes. Israel kills.
Mona, quickly, if you can, when you have an incident that happens in the occupied territories as a whole that involves Palestinian and Israeli security forces, and something happens, let's say a death happens or an injury happens, who can the Palestinians turn to in order to get justice? I mean, do they have anybody they can refer to? How does that work?
Well, Palestinians can't get justice here because we are speaking about Israeli forces, Israeli military occupation forces. Of course, we're not going to the Israeli courts to get Palestinians' rights. That's why the Palestinian Authority and the leadership were trying to reach the International Criminal Court to bring justice for Palestinians, especially that speaking about killing children, Defense for Children International have accused the Israeli forces for using deadly force and sometimes carrying out extrajudicial killings among the children. That's why they were trying to bring Israeli soldiers for trial. However, in this case, the Israeli court would bring the Israeli soldiers and claim they are suing them. However, at the end of the day, they would receive only months for killing a Palestinian child or another in cold blood.
Okay, thank you for that. That's a correspondent there. Mona Kandil from Occupied Ramallah. Nick Napier, thank you very much. Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign. And with that, we come to an end for this news review.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
Listeners, we're going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. The father of the Islamic Revolution emphasized the safeguarding of the revolution and the Islamic Republic system is the greatest obligatory act. In today's program, we're going to touch upon his concerns about the enemy's conspiracies to disappoint the people from Islam and undermine their unity. Please stay with us. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to say that among the conspiracies of the enemies is to demonstrate Islam as inefficient to adapt itself to the problems of the modern world and to tackle problems of contemporary man. He used to warn the masses and scholars that two groups of people are trying to depict Islam as unable to solve social and political problems. The first group ignorantly considers Islam far from the social and political arenas of human life, and the second group wickedly denies the political identity of this religion. The Imam wrote in his testament, "One of the important plots which can be seen, especially during the contemporary decades and particularly after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, is the widespread propaganda with different dimensions to disappoint the nation, especially the selfless Iranian nation, from Islam. Sometimes they say ineptly and expressly that the laws of Islam that have been passed 1,400 years ago cannot administer countries in the modern era, or that Islam is a reactionary religion and opposed to any innovation and civilization, and that in the modern era you cannot keep countries away from global civilization and its manifestations. Such foolish and occasionally sly and devilish propagandas are forged in the form of advocacy of Islam by raising issues like saying that Islam and other divine religions are engaged in spirituality, worshipping and praying, and government and politics are against their spiritual aim and purpose. And sadly, the second type of propaganda, separation of religion from politics, has affected some religious scholars or ulama and religious people who are unaware of Islam to the extent that they even consider interference in government and politics as sin and transgression. This is a great catastrophe that Islam has been suffering from." founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, made it clear that individual and social laws of Islam do not become outdated with the passage of time. Imam Khomeini reiterated that this claim is like saying that the laws of mathematics change with time. He wrote in his testament, "As for the first group, it should be said that they are either unaware of government, law and politics, or they partially feign being unaware because execution of laws on the basis of justice and prevention of injustice and oppressive rule and spread of individual and social justice and prohibition of corruption, indecency and various kinds of waywardness and freedom based on the criterion of intellect, justice and independence and prevention of colonialism, exploitation and worship of others instead of God, and implementation of divine fixed rules, retaliation and specific rules on the basis of justice and fairness, and hundreds of the like are not the things to become outdated with the passage of time. In the history of mankind and social life, this is quite clear. This dispute is like saying that the laws of physics, the laws of science, and the laws of mathematics change with the passage of time, and that other rules should replace them. Claiming that Islam is opposed to innovation is no more than a foolish allegation, because if the manifestation of civilization mean inventions and advanced industries, Islam and no other monotheistic religion have been or will ever be opposed to it. Rather, science and industry are emphasized in Islam and the noble Quran. Khomeini, may God bless his soul, also said in his testament, "As for the second group who design sly schemes and consider Islam separate from rule of politics, these ignorant people should be told that the Holy Quran and the practice of the Messenger of God, blessings of God upon him and his messenger, have so many laws on rule and politics that they exceed other areas. It is rather due to negligence of many ritual political laws of Islam that have caused these catastrophes. The Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, formed a ruling like other ruling systems in the world, but with the motive of spreading social justice. That the first caliphs of Islam had vast rules and the rule of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, was founded more vastly with the same motive are among the axioms of history. And after that, gradually the ruling system was in the name of Islam, and now too there are many who claim to follow Islam and the Holy Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, in Islamic ruling system." Imam Khomeini also wrote in his testament, "I hope all writers, socialists and historians will take Muslims out of this mistake. What has been said that the messengers were engaged in spirituality and government and the affairs of world are rejected, and that the divine messengers and saints would refrain from them, and thus we should also follow them, is an unfortunate mistake, whose consequences are to corrupt the Islamic nations and opening the way for the bloodthirsty colonialism. Because what is rejected are the satanic, dictatorial and oppressive rules, which have been prevented due to seeking dominance and pervert worldly motives that they had. But the rightful rule for the benefit of the downtrodden and prevention of oppression and injustice and for establishment of social justice is the same principle, for instance, of Prophet Solomon, the son of David, peace be upon him, and Grand Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and his great legatees would try for it. This is among the greatest obligations, and the maintenance of it is among the loftiest worships, as the healthy politics that existed in these rules is among the necessary affairs."
سيدي ومولاي ومعتمدي ورجائي.
The ocean of dua.
الإمام الحسين عليه السلام زيارة مني ونيابة عن والدي.
Why did you leave us to fend for ourselves, Hussein, Hussein, the slain.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Madarisi, and in this edition of The Ocean of Dua, we are trying to discuss and talk about the different aspects of زيارة إمام الحسين عليه السلام، زيارة العاشوراء. So stay with us.
فلعن الله أمتان أسست أساس الظلم والجار، عليكم أهل البيت. ولعن الله أمتان دفعتكم عن مقامكم وأزالتكم عن مراتبكم التي رتبكم الله فيها.
In the previous program, dear listeners, we started talking about the important consequences of laying the foundation of wrongdoing and injustice against the Ahlul Bayt عليهم السلام. فلعن الله أمة أسست أساس الظلم والجور عليكم أهل البيت. Why do these oppressors deserve to be cursed by the Almighty Allah, deserve to be away from His mercy? One aspect of that it can be seen throughout the different traditions of the Ahlul Bayt about the effects and the consequences of starting this oppression against the Ahlul Bayt. The first consequence that we started talking about was facilitating deviation in Islamic beliefs among Muslim Ummah, the deviation in wilayah and guardianship, for example. Imam Abu Ja'far al-Baqir alayhi salam is reported to have said, فوالله لو أن رجلا عبد الله عمره ما بين الركن والمقام ثم مات ولم يجئ بولايتنا لأكبه الله في النار على وجه. I swear by Allah, if a man were to worship Allah throughout his life between Ar-Rukn and Al-Maqam and thereafter die but not come with our wilayah and guardianship, which imam means the accepting of that fact, Allah would throw him down on his face into the fire of hell. This very imam is also reported to have said, indeed the garden of heaven craves for the arrival of the progeny of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and their followers, and its light intensifies on their arrival. And if a slave of Allah were to worship Allah without our love and our guardianship between Rukn and Maqam until such an extent that his joints are severed, Allah would not accept that from him. And this deviation, not accepting the guardianship of the true imams, this is what led to the people standing in the face of their imam and what happened in the events of Karbala.
When people ask, I'm confused about which school is right or which madhab is right, go to Karbala. Look at Karbala, it clarifies it instantaneously. Anybody says, I'm confused, say, please go to Karbala and tell me what happened, why it happened, and what does it have to do with your religion. You will see it completely exemplifies. It clarifies, it takes all the blurs out instantaneously. SubhanAllah, that's the miracle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein alayhi salam's main foundation of morality is do not allow tyranny, do not allow evil doing, do not allow indecency. Why is Imam like this? Because he knows Allah, he appreciates him, he understands his dimensions. That's why we must love them so much. We must love them so much that don't let anybody else take us away from them. There should be no room in our thoughts. No matter who we admire in this world, no matter how great a person we look at, never move the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt out of the center of the heart. Never. They will know that their Khalifa lied to them because he told them they don't pray. And if they see them praying on the battlefield, their hearts will change. So stop them from praying. Imagine how evil these people were. That's how much lies they had. And you cannot eradicate this lie at the level that we are talking about unless you give your blood for the love of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Imam Abu Hassan al-Ridha alayhi salam is reported to have said, "Inna al-imamata usul Islam." Indeed, imama and divine leadership is the base of the religion of Islam. Bil imami tamamu salati wa zakati wa siyami wal hajj wal jihad. Through imam is achieved the completeness of prayer, zakat, fasting, hajj and jihad. And it was because of the disregarding of the fundamental belief of imama that the rest of the roots of religion, like tawheed, adl, ma'ad, etc., were misunderstood. Misleading ideas such as determinism and anthropomorphism, literalism, etc., crept into the Muslim nation. This was the start of that deviation. The Shia of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, however, remaining steadfast to the rope of imamah, never deviated from the path of salvation and maintained the correct principles and branches of faith. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam had guaranteed them by saying, "Ma in tamassaktum bihima lan tadhillu abada." As long as you hold fast onto them both, that is, the Holy Quran and my infallible household, you shall never go astray. And although you may have achieved the greatness of this impact and the importance of the fundamental consequence of laying this foundation, this was only one of the consequences. But yet the most important one, since belief is the most important pillar elevating the man, and this is what renders his actions validated. This is what validates his deeds and actions. In the next program, we'll try to discuss another consequence of laying the foundation of oppression against the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
الذي صنعت من الرمح منبرا ظمآن والزمان بعينيك ممطرا نعم الأمير أنت حسين وقدوتي ساروا إليك قلبي وعقلي ودمعتي يا محيي الكرامة تبكيك كل عام لبيك يا إمامي لبيك يا حسين الروح بالدم لبيك يا حسين
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In late July, Tunisian President Kais Saied invoked emergency powers, fired the Prime Minister and suspended Parliament for 30 days. In a televised address, he said the measures would remain in place until social peace returns to Tunisia. Long hailed as the only success story of the so-called Arab Spring uprisings, Tunisia now faces its most dangerous political crisis since the revolution a decade ago.
حادث الحدث مؤلم جدا لجميع السعوديين.
The
political turmoil has once again thrown into sharp relief the subversive roles of the Saudis and Emiratis in Tunisia. Well-informed Saudi sources have revealed financial promises made by the two Arab regimes to the Tunisian president. The Saudi whistleblower Mujtahid tweeted that Saudi Arabia and the UAE are prepared to give $5 billion to Saeed if the coup, as he puts it, succeeds. Mujtahid has also revealed that Saudi Arabia and the UAE operated about 700,000 Facebook accounts, mostly fake, to incite against parliament and support the so-called coup or turmoil.
And Hadda, which is the largest party in the parliament that was suspended, which is Brotherhood, it's Muslim Brotherhood related, they are against what they call Saeed's coup. Saeed is the president. Saeed suspended parliament. That is called a coup. And I agree that the Ennahda is not happy with Saeed's suspension of parliament.
An anonymous source privy to the Saudi court has recently told Saudi leaks that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman secretly called Saeed prior to his controversial decision and encouraged him to dissolve the parliament so as to isolate the Ennahda of the Islamic Renaissance Party from the Tunisian political scene. Meanwhile, Anwar Gargesh, diplomatic advisor to the UAE president, met with Saeed amidst the turmoil to voice his support for Saeed. Ennahda, the biggest party in Tunisia's parliament, has consequently accused the UAE of playing a role in what the party calls Saeed's power grab.
The UAE doesn't have... it's trying to throw its weight around. It's in Yemen. It's on Mars. It's on the moon. It's a little tiny dictatorship throwing its weight around far beyond its position. It's incredible position.
Strangely enough, 3 days before Saeed's announcement, Tahir Khalfan Tamim, Dubai's deputy police chief, tweeted a cryptic message. Good news, a new blow, powerful, coming to the Brotherhood. A reference to Ennahda's links to the Muslim Brotherhood group.
Egypt is military, and they are very much in favor of overthrowing the Ennahda parliament in Tunisia. So I think that it's possible that Sisi in Egypt is actually behind pressuring Saeed, the president of Tunisia, to suspend parliament and then to keep it suspended. And basically he can rule by decree. That is what Sisi is effectively doing in Egypt. And he doesn't like democracy, he doesn't like the Muslim Brotherhood.
Shortly after the Tunisian president's decision, U.S. Senator Chris Murphy called on the Biden administration to investigate the case. He tweeted, "What role are Saudi Arabia and UAE playing in the Tunisian crisis? The Biden administration should seek the answer to this question post-haste." Saeed's takeover had been covered favorably by media in Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Saudi Arabia's Okaz daily newspaper had an entire front page on Tunisia with the headline, "Tunisia rises up against the Brotherhood." For its part, the UAE has refrained from offering an official reaction to the recent development in Tunisia. But the Emirati news outlet 24 Media, for example, published a piece on the political crisis entitled, "A Brave Decision to Save Tunisia."
And Hadda is, as far as I understand, is not backed by Saudi Arabia. It is backed by Qatar. Qatar is the one that is backing the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and elsewhere. And they have been protecting Muslim Brotherhood. So I think that the Saudis are against Ennahda, and they do not like democracy. They are much like Sisi. And each and the Saudis are working together against the Ennahda in Tunisia. So that is the situation with the Saudis.
Abu Dhabi and Riyadh have both been highly critical of the Ennahda party, which formed a government after the 2011 revolution, as it has been described as an example of how political Islam and democracy could work together. Former Tunisian President Moncef Marzouki, who served from 2011 to 2014, said, "No doubt that the UAE is behind this coup." When it comes to subversive plots in Tunisia, Abu Dhabi in particular has been a fixture both in rumors and reports. Last year, it was reported that Turkish intelligence had foiled an attempted coup plot inside Tunisia, which was allegedly coordinated by the United Arab Emirates. Riyadh and Abu Dhabi have reportedly been using social media accounts to stir up anger online and drive the country further into chaos. In the words of Mark Owen Jones, a professor at Hamad bin Khalifa University in Doha, "To me, this is absolutely typical of Emirati and Saudi campaigns. It's almost like a classic signature of accounts you'd expect to see engaged in this type of behavior."
All the bad guys, US, Saudis, Sisi in Egypt, they are against the Brotherhood, wherever it is, whether it's in Tunisia or Egypt or Syria. They prefer a strong man in power. There are other forces that are happy with instability. Now, I don't think the Saudis want instability in Tunisia. They would prefer an autocracy like they have. So I don't know who's really benefiting by what's happening now in Tunisia. I think it's very complex and unclear, and there's many factors and many actors. And if you want to divide it into good and bad, I will stand by supporting the Brotherhood as the forces basically of the people, and the moderate forces and the uncorrupt forces.
It cannot be understated the insidious role the UAE and Saudi Arabia have been playing to stir up civil unrest in Tunisia. The two authoritarian regimes will not stop working to destabilize Tunisia, the symbol of a freedom-seeking nation in the entire Arab world.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.